Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Ashley Chalinor.
Hi.
Ashley, would you introduce yourself?
Sure. I am a normal citizen. I'm not a podcaster or entertainer. In my day job, I'm the director of policy at the Ontario Chamber of Commerce. That's about it. I'm an avid podcast listener and avid reader.
You are responsible for for us taking on this work, which is, heaven help us all, William Faulkner's magnum opus, Absalom, Absalom. You want to talk a little bit about your history with this novel?
Sure. I first read this this book in a fourth year English class. And I was not an English major. I just happened to take a course on American literature. It was a bit of a shock to the system after reading, you know, things like Twain and more, you know, accessible authors, which is most authors, really. But I really fell in love with this book because I was a history major, and I found that it had a lot to say about the telling of history, the creation of history, and the relationship between what are personal stories and how they evolve into a historical tale. And so that made it easier for me to get into the book itself, regardless of how difficult the language is. And it's meant that the book has kind of stayed in my mind in the intervening decade.
My own history with this book is Faulkner I did not read in high school. I did read him in college, where the first book I read was actually the long short story, The Bear, which is quite often given as sort of an introduction to Faulkner, mm-hmm. because it's seen as kind of manageable, but it confused the hell out of me. And to this day, I still am not quite sure about one plot point in that story. But after that, I went on in grad school. I took a course in modernism in American literature, and Faulkner was at the end of the little unit on stream of consciousness, and read The Sound and the Fury, which is the book by Faulkner that I think most people will read. And I thought, oh, this is not as hard as everyone says it is. And I read after that As I Lay Dying, which I think is a quite easy book to read, actually. And I thought, man, people make this Faulkner out to be this monster, but he's really quite accessible. And then I took a seminar in Faulkner, and we were given Absalom, Absalom first, and I hit a brick wall. This is probably the most dense book I've ever read, and I've read Ulysses, and it's dense in a way that is hard to describe, mm-hmm. but we'll get to that.
Well, it's interesting. I have never read The Sound and the Fury. After finishing Absalom, Absalom, I kind of said to myself, well, now you have to, because it is this sort of companion piece with, Quentin Compson appearing in both. Then I developed a case of senioritis, and it never happened. So there's still time, well, I guess.
There's plenty of time. Go back. I think if you've made your way through Absalom, Absalom, you'll have no trouble with The Sound and the Fury.
Okay.
Let me take a moment here to try and encapsulate the story. And I warn people ahead of time, no encapsulation can really explain this book, the experience of reading this book. So if you haven't read the book and you want to go in unspoiled, maybe skip this podcast for a bit. But in any case, here goes. Absalom, which was written in 1936, is the story of Thomas Sutpen, who's a poor white man who arrives mysteriously in Jefferson, Missouri in 1833. He seeks to build a mansion, a plantation, and a legacy for himself. The novel follows his rise and falls in the years leading up to and following the Civil War, and then continues with the eventual outcome of his property, Sutpen's Hundred. The story is related to Quentin Compson, who's on loan from the earlier novel, The Sound and the Fury. The story is related in 1909 by three different interlocutors, Miss Rosa Coldfield, who's the elderly sister of Sutpen's wife, Ellen Coldfield, who wants, for reasons of her own, to have Sutpen's story told. It's also related to Quentin by his father, just called Mr. Compson. His father, Quentin's grandfather, was a friend of Sutpen's. And finally, it's speculated upon and elaborated upon with Quentin's Harvard roommate, Shreve, who may be from Canada and is trying really hard to understand what's up with the South. The same story in the book is told many times. It's pretty much outlined in the first chapter and then enlarged upon, changed, speculated upon. Sutpen's ambitions to create a dynasty is viewed with distaste and distrust by the town, and they initially oppose his marriage to Ellen. Sutpen eventually has two children by Ellen, named Henry and Judith, and one by a slave, the unfortunately named Clytemnestra. There's also an itinerant worker named Wash Jones, who's squatting on an old camp, and he's there with his daughter Millie Jones. On the eve of the Civil War, Henry, now a young man, is studying in New Orleans, and he makes the acquaintance of a debonair, suave guy named Charles Bond, and the two of them have sort of a bromance. He brings him back to Sutpen's Hundred, and it seems for a while as though Bond is going to romance and marry Judith, but Sutpen doesn't like the look of Bond and forbids his marriage and explains his reasons to Henry. Those reasons remain mysterious at first, but Henry and Bond break off their friendship and go to war. At first, the story that comes out in the novel is that Bond is unacceptable because he had a mixed-race mistress back in New Orleans. But eventually, through the course of memory and speculation, it comes out that he is actually Sutpen's son by an earlier wife he had in the French Indies, where he worked as a slave overseer. And the wife had turned out to be of mixed race. At the end of the war, Bond sends a letter announcing that he's coming to marry Ellen anyway, but Henry arrives at Sutpen's Hundred and kills Bond at the gates of the plantation, and then he disappears. At the war's end, Sutpen comes back and finds his dreams of grandeur in ruin and tries to make ends meet selling supplies to freed slaves. He proposes marriage after the death of his wife to Miss Rosa, who is his wife's younger sister, if you'll recall, and she accepts the offer, if only to look after her niece's interests. But then he demands that she bear him a son before he marries, and offended, she leaves Sutpen's Hundred. Eventually, Sutpen descends into alcoholism and takes up with the daughter of the itinerant laborer Wash Jones, Millie Jones, and she becomes pregnant and dies in childbirth. Wash Jones, in turn, kills Sutpen with a scythe in 1869. In the present day, which is, again, 1909, Miss Rosa believes that someone has been living in the mansion, and she and Quentin go to investigate, finding Clytemnestra caring for the elderly dying Henry, who has returned to the mansion to expire. Also living in Sutpen's Hundred is the half-witted grandson of Charles Bond, whose name is Jim Bond. When Rosa decides to try and bring Henry to a hospital, Clyde sets the house on fire, killing herself and Henry. Jim alone survives. As the book ends in 1910, Miss Rosa is dead, and Shreve and Quentin are speculating on what is still unknown. And Shreve asks the book's final question, why does he hate the South? So.
Well done.
Thank you.
You have made it sound like this book had a straightforward plot.
The thing to understand about this is you can reconstruct this after the fact. Faulkner provides some very handy appendices, like a chronological set of dates at the end, so you can reconstruct it. None of this is clear as you're reading it.
No. But it's, you know, it's, I normally like straightforward kind of plot heavy books, but the pleasure of figuring out what Faulkner's doing and becoming, you know, one of these narrators who's just trying to come to the bottom of not only the story but the motivations of the people in the story is really enjoyable. And so as difficult as the language can be, the actual structure of hearing the story over and over again and just getting a new layer or a new angle to it, is really fun.
Yeah, it's fun, and it's also a little maddening because one of the games he likes to play is people's motivations aren't clear at first, and then people speculate on things, and Quentin's father comes up with a solution to why Henry and Charles Bond have broken off their friendship that turns out to not be correct. And you only learn that, you know, maybe 3 chapters later, and then you have to reevaluate what you're what the story is. And as the book goes along, it moves from a witness who was on the scene, Rosa, who nonetheless is not going to tell you everything because she has reasons of her own not to tell what's going on. And then you've got Quentin's dad, who heard it all secondhand from his dad. And then you've got Shreve, who, what the hell does he know? He was living up in wherever, you know, across the
What,
border.
yeah, what does he know? He's Canadian.
Exactly. How do we tackle a book like this? Where do you want to start?
How do you solve the problem of Absalom Absalom? Let's talk by, I guess, moving from the outwards in. Let's talk about Shreve. So, I think I mentioned this. It's not explicitly stated in the text that Shreve is Canadian. There's just conjecture that he's Canadian. I think at some point he's referred to as being from the north. But he, in his conversations with Quentin about the South and about the Civil War, he doesn't appear to have any sort of emotional attachment to this part of history. He doesn't appear to have any sort of, you know, preordained opinions or a perspective that one that you would expect to have. You know, if you were an American, regardless of where in the US you come from, you probably have feelings about the Civil War. And so I think it's safe to assume that that Shreve isn't American. And so as a Canadian myself, reading this book about the South and about the kind of brother against brother conflict of the Civil War, you know, I have that similar kind of step removed. And so when, you know, Shreve asks the big questions in the final chapter about, you know, why does Quentin hate the South but also trying to kind of understand why this is the story that Quentin chooses to tell him when he asks, you know, what's the South like? What's your relationship with the South? That's certainly a feeling that I can relate to. And so going into this book, which is you know, not something that is part of my you know, personal or national history, I found it interesting to have that kind of narrator who acts as a link to this country and the story.
Yeah, Shreve is a funny guy. There's an interesting dynamic in a novelist like Faulkner, who writes quite often about some of the worst aspects of Southern culture. And I think it's telling that the Southern authors that have made it big outside the South, people like Faulkner, people like Flannery O'Connor, people to a certain extent like Twain, are ones that are willing to be highly self-critical. And that's a kind of a strange dynamic because it seems like you're playing to the North's opinions about the South. At the end of the novel, Shreve has been asking all kinds of questions. He's like, why is Miss Rosa saying this? Is Miss Rosa your aunt? Why do you even care what goes on? And Quentin's trying to explain what his relationship is to this story and why it matters at all. And to Shreve, it's all history and all academic, and why would you even care? But it has become very personal for Quentin. And so when he ends on this line about why do you hate the South, and Quentin says, I don't hate the South, I don't, I don't. it left me, I remember when I read this book the first time, feeling like I'd really seen someone airing their dirty laundry in a way that made me highly uncomfortable. It's sort of like, mm-hmm. I think it really personalized for me the feelings that I think I've heard from a lot of people from the South about how tired they are of having to justify their history to outsiders, and yet how complicated their own relationships to that history are.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's easy for those of us who aren't from the South to, you know, make broad judgments, perhaps even unfair judgments, based on history, but also based on sometimes contemporary activity, and to do so in a way that is sweeping, you know, and to assume that any sort of perhaps right-thinking Southerner should feel the same way that we do, which is to, you know, consign the whole thing to the trash heap of history. So, you know, there is, and perhaps this is one of the reasons why, you know, Faulkner is so beloved and respected, is, you know, he does have that critical eye, but he also gets to, as you said, that very personal heart of the relationship between the Southerner and the South. And that's something that I think needs to be reflected to a non-Southern audience. I guess it's very easy to come from the South and say, you know, you're totally right. Slavery was unjustifiable, and our cause in the war was unjustifiable, and so on and so forth. But it's another thing to be able to have that kind of nuanced feeling of what home means for you, and the ability of your region and your culture to shape your personality and you know, your path in a way that is recognized as something that isn't exclusively negative, that it is just a matter of fact. And so to have that reflection, and I think, again, it's important that Quentin is having this conversation with someone who could not possibly understand, who doesn't come with American baggage, and so who needs to have it spelled out for them. Although it is interesting, because in that, I guess it's that final chapter where Shreve is questioning Quentin on all of these things, and he makes some comment about... after the war, you know, your grandfather is lost and the slaves were freed, or was it the other way around, that your grandfather's lost their, or their grandfather's won and the slaves were the ones who lost? I can't remember the exact quote, but he is kind of picking at Quentin there a little bit, and picking at this this narrative that was coming out of the South, and to some extent still comes out of the South. So having that complexity in one page is kind of incredible, but so valuable.
I think the other thing that is remarkable about this book is the way that it combines a highly particular narrative. I mean, it's a very complicated family narrative about particular people with this overarching meta-narrative about the South and the whole project of the Southern experience. Mm-hmm. In the end, so much in this story hinges upon the racial imagination, upon mm-hmm. the fact that Sutphin cannot let go of the idea of miscegenation. And there's a great line. It's Quentin and Shreve speculating on an interchange between Charles Bond and Henry during the war. You know, it's a completely made-up scene. There's no reason to believe this happened at all, but they imagine them tending to each other on the battlefield, and the fact that Henry is going to oppose Bond's marriage to his sister, and Bond says, it's not the incest that bothers you, it's the miscegenation.
Yeah.
It's quite shocking. It's so weird and perverse in the way that Faulkner can be weird and perverse. Mm-hmm. There are sexual overtones between Henry and Charles. There are sexual overtones between Henry and his sister Judith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Compson calls all of this out. This is his explanation, right? Well, and it's interesting that you bring up that you know, Henry being so committed to his racism that he'll accept incest instead. And this sort of commentary, you know, as obviously Quentin is trying to use the story as an allegory for his explanation of the South, but to comment upon, you know, everything that is being built, everything that Sutpen was trying to build, and everything the South was trying to build was, you know, always going to be built on a unsteady and immoral foundation of racism and slavery, and so was doomed to fail. And this sort of attitude that Henry had, that he'd be willing to have his family enter into this perverse union, so, you know, as long as he could preserve his father's design, is just part of that kind of house of cards that that I think Quentin is trying to explain to Shreve, that the, you know, the downfall came from this perverse view of what is right and wrong.
The racial imagination of this novel is complicated and sometimes problematic. For example, the final outcome of Sutpen's line is Jim Bond.
Right.
And he's presented as this kind of a product of poor breeding, this idea that somehow, because he's both black and white, he is mentally deficient, and even Shreve joins in at this at the end and says, you know, oh, it seems like, and let's face it, this book uses the N-word quite a lot mm-hmm. throughout the course of this book, and Shreve is going to join in sort of dismissing Bond as the genetic mistake of this crossbreeding, and yet he says, and that seems to me like what has inherited the South.
Yeah.
I suspect Faulkner thought he was being a bit progressive by suggesting that perhaps the inheritance of the South would go to the mixture of races, but it's also full of this kind of gross genetic badness.
Yeah, it's almost like he wrote himself into a corner because he couldn't have Jim Bond be, you know, a successful person, right? Because Sutpen's line has to end. It has to be his you know, everything he built has to fall apart. But at the same time, he wants to make this point about the future being, you know, the mixture of races, I suppose. I'm not sure. It's, I don't know. It's a tough one.
Yeah, I mean, part of that has to do with ultimately Faulkner treats his African-American characters here and elsewhere very much like others. I mean, in The Sound of the Fury, there is a highly sympathetic portrayal of an elderly African-American woman named Dilsey, but even there, she's treated very much like, oh, this is different than you, reader. This is different than me, writer. It's like, this is the unknowable. You know, I'm not going to make an excuse for that. That's ultimately a failure of Faulkner's imagination.
Definitely.
So one thing that that came up this time as I was reading, and the book is, as I've mentioned before, very dense. We'll get to the style a little later on here, but I found myself having a harder time reading it than I did back in grad school.
Oh,
I think
me too.
When I was, you know, when I was in grad school, I had a lot more patience for this sort of thing, and also, I don't think I was as apt to fall asleep while reading as I am now. And the one thing that I still don't quite understand is, early in the book, we're given this false reason for Charles Bond and Henry falling out, that it was all about the fact that Bond had a mixed race mistress in New Orleans. And that was something that was given by Quentin's father. Later in the book, when we learn that Charles Bond is actually Sutpen's son from the previous marriage, that is relayed via a story that was handed down from Quentin's grandfather, but presumably through Quentin's father. And I don't understand why the two stories then.
It seems as though the grandfather told Quentin, but not Quentin's father. And it's not clear why that is. And I don't know if it's because, you know, Mr. Compson, Quentin's father, had, you know, a bit more connection to the story, and so perhaps had just decided within himself what had happened and didn't kind of seek out, you know, further perspectives or any other eyewitnesses or parts of the story, whereas Quentin was actively investigating the story. He wanted to know what happened, and he wanted to try to reconstruct it. So it's possible that, you know, he had asked his grandfather, and Mr. Compson never did, because he had his own ideas, and that wasn't going to sway him. You know, he has this very strong, I guess, deterministic streak. He believes in fate. He believes that, you know, men's actions are not their own. And so doesn't seem like the type to go out to try to disprove his own theory. Whereas Quentin is a bit more open and is clearly searching for answers.
The instigating part of the story is when Miss Rosa summons Quentin on the eve of his going to Harvard to tell her story about her relationship with Sutphen and Sutphen's Hundred. And it's unclear to Quentin at first, just as it is later unclear to Shreve, why she is doing this. And there's a lot of speculation back and forth between his father and him about her motives, that she thinks that Quentin has as good a chance as any to become the great muse of the South, you know, that he's going to go off and become a literary figure. And she wants her story to be told as, I suppose, revenge against Sutphen for what he did to her and to his sister, or to her sister.
Yeah, she wants her version of the story to become the official story.
Tellingly, she leaves out quite a few details that Mr. Compson fills in. And then when we get to the sections that are related by way of Quentin's grandfather, that seems even further removed. That seems at once both further removed, and yet it's the way in which we get to see what Sutphen's version of the story is, because Sutphen confided in Quentin's grandfather while they were chasing the architect who he brought with him to build his mansion, who was trying to run away into the swamp.
The architect they kidnapped, essentially, and held against his will.
That's another wonderful passage, is the whole building this mansion in the middle of the swamp. By force of will, he's going to create this palace, but at first he kind of doesn't know what he's doing, and everything, there's no furnishings in the house, and there's no windows, and it's in the middle of undrained swamp, and it's just kind of like him, this big house with all of his slaves. Eventually he's able to bring in all the furnishings and appointments, and with the marriage to Ellen, he thinks he's going to finally make it in you know, the town. He's going to finally arrive to the point that the people will have no choice but to accept him as one of them.
Right. Yeah. That's been his obsession since he was this poor young man who you know, had doors closed in his face, and so what he was building was, you know, not necessarily a big home or a big bank account or a successful, you know, arrangement through marriage, alliance through marriage, but was in fact building a name for himself and his family that would never be, you know, turned away from anything. And I mean, this obviously, you know, is fatally kind of damaged by the idea that he would have a son, or rather a son-in-law who was Bond was 1/6 black or something like that, and so this very minor issue would in Sutphen's mind and probably in the reality of that time prevent that this family legacy that he wanted to leave, that no one could ever deny a Sutphen anything anymore.
When I was reading this through, it seemed to me like a very interesting companion piece to The Great Gatsby, which was written in 1925, and which is also considered one of the great works of American modernism. And there we have another story about people trying to reinvent themselves and trying to arrive at the top of the heap. And that is sort of the northern story of what it means to try to make yourself upper class in what's ostensibly a classless society. This is kind of the Southern story of what it means to try and, through force of will, become an aristocrat. I don't know if I have anything more to say, except that I thought it was really interesting having read The Great Gatsby just about a year earlier for this podcast.
In terms of the South, looking at it just from the perspective of class, especially at that time, you know, poor white men had one important thing they could cling to. They're not black, and so had certain expectations and feelings of entitlement about, you know, where they could go in society and what they could do because of that you know, very important piece of power and privilege that they held. And so to have that, you know, Sutpen to see that as, you know, his downfall would have been especially insulting because of how poor he started his life as. You know, to him, he would always have that birthright over other citizens of the South. Whereas in the North, I mean, obviously, there was certainly you know, racial components to it, but at least in The Great Gatsby, it did seem to be more straightforward, you know, story of money and the type of money that you had.
You mentioned another comparison you wanted to make.
Yeah, so I did a little bit of digging and found my original essay from university when I read this book, and I'd forgotten that it was actually a comparison of Absalom Absalom and Willa Cather's My Antonia. You know, the thesis was about you know, historiography and the telling of history. There's a quote from a particular academic that I used, Lynn Garchwell-Levins. The fact of history may be objective, but the recreation of history is not. And so I compared the narrators of both novels, but, you know, most appropriately, Quentin and Jim, excuse me, sorry. I compared the narrators of both novels, but specifically Quentin and Jim Burden, who narrates My Antonia, in the sense that they were both attempting to understand their personal history and recreate their personal relationship with their history through telling these stories. You know, with Jim, it's more soaked in nostalgia for this perfect childhood in Nebraska, whereas is Quentin, it's darker and more searching. There's a passage in My Antonia that essentially a group of characters come across a kind of burned area in a field. And two of the characters have very different interpretations of why this area is burned. Essentially, one is positive and one is negative. And this kind of, you know, kind of puts a pin into this this point of a matter of personal perspective when talking about history or making history. So, you know, with Quentin especially, he's using the story of Sutpen as an allegory, and he's using it to, because it's become so far removed over the years, to be part of the history of the South. As a former history student, I found that very fascinating. You know, how history is so much more than an intellectual discussion. It's a personal and an emotional discussion as well. You know, when we tell history, especially a history of, you know, where we're from, it's more than just a retelling of facts. It's about trying to find meaning and trying to ascribe meaning as well.
Well, you know, one thing that, as you were mentioning that to me, that I was also thinking about is Absalom Absalom, My Antonia, and The Great Gatsby all have narrators who sort of fade in and out.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of on the edges of the actual events of the book, and it's questionable at times why they know what they know about the events that are happening in the book.
Right.
It's quite interesting that these books that are all obsessed with memory and the continuance of memory. I know exactly which passage you're talking about in My Antonia, by the way. That,
oh, nice.
It was, I think I wrote a paper on that too. but that's a sort of a passage in which the land itself has memory, but it's unclear what that memory means.
Right.
And so Absalom, again, is a book about several different people looking at the same events and having completely different interpretations. And yet it's ultimately, in a metatextual way, about an even broader story. And so that conflict between personal interpretation and the idea of regional identity or national identity is quite central to all these works.
Well, it's interesting too that both My Antonia and Absalom have an element of the author kind of inserting themselves into the narration. So, you know, in Absalom, there are essentially four narrators, but there are a few instances where it appears as though it's Faulkner giving his kind of omniscient narration. Although with all the narration, there's no kind of clear indication of who's speaking when, and you have to kind of figure it out from the text itself. Whereas in My Antonia, there's kind of a sort of a Willa Cather almost character who is part of the narration itself. Although that's another book I haven't read in a decade. And so I can't remember exactly how that's used, but, you know, it is kind of curious how, and why perhaps the authors decided to insert themselves into that.
This is not a podcast about My Antonia, but before we leave that behind, I do think that it's interesting that My Antonia starts with two chapters in which the narrator, Jim Burton, erases himself literally from the story. At the beginning of the story, he's going off to live somewhere else after the death of his parents. Mm-hmm. And he talks about on the trip there, how he feels utterly, his ego has been utterly stripped away from him. His identity has been stripped away from him and nothing else exists. But once he arrives in Nebraska, he feels this kind of an oceanic experience of the natural world and being there under the sky and saying, I felt completely at ease, like I had ceased to be and that I was part of everything. Mm-hmm. Now if we can relate that somehow to Faulkner here, Quentin is dealing with sort of he's inescapably returning to childhood, and not just to childhood, but to events that happened 100 years before he was born. Mm-hmm. And those things are as real to him now as anything. And that's part of what confuses Shreve about it, is why is he hanging on to these things and why is he personalizing these things and why is that part of his identity? And the feeling one gets is from here is that Quentin desperately would like to escape that. Mm-hmm. If he could. Now, to go extra textual here for a minute, to go back to The Sound of the Fury, one of the things that's funny about Quentin in this book is Quentin in The Sound of the Fury is defined largely by his relationship to his sister, Caddy, to whom he has kind of, again, incestuous feelings, and dealing with his emotions about her having left the family and disappeared. And eventually in The Sound of the Fury, he commits suicide. The thing that's strange to me about this book is no mention is made of that other plot line,
mm-hmm.
which was so much in Quentin's head in the earlier book and informs every aspect of his character. Anyone who's read the earlier book knows what Quentin's eventual fate is going to be.
Right.
And that can't help but color the way that you feel about the end of this book. But this book places Quentin's depression and his feelings of being unable to escape the past into this kind of a larger historical context than simply his family history.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Quentin, because he dies so young, he never has children. So he, you know, his obsession with the past, it kind of he is held in the past. There's no sort of dynasty for him. There's no kind of continuation of his story through children. You know, similar in some ways to Sutpen, who had, you know, hoped to kind of create this this long line and this dynasty, but is now kind of consigned to myth. He's a representative of the South, but he has not, it is not part of the South, or the continuing story of the South, I should say, because his family ends with, as noted, Jim Bond, the quote idiot in the story.
Oh, by the way, I want to apologize to anyone who I spoiled the end of The Sound of the Fury for.
Oh, it's been out for how many decades? Are literary spoilers a thing?
I assume so. But in any case, okay, let's take a minute here to talk about style of this book, because if you enjoy this book, you have to enjoy the style. And if you can't make it through the book, it will be the style that defeats you. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about the opening lines of this book. This book actually opens with my favorite first sentence in all of literature.
From a little after 2 o'clock until almost sundown of the long, still hot, weary, dead September afternoon, they sat in what Miss Coldfield still called the office, because her father had called it that. A dim, hot, airless room where the blinds all closed and fastened for 43 summers, because when she was a girl, someone had believed that light and moving air carried heat and that dark was always cooler, and which, as the sun shone fuller and fuller on that side of the house, became latticed with yellow slashes full of dust motes, which Quentin thought of as being flecks of the dead old dried paint itself, blown inward from the scaling blinds as wind might have blown them. There was a wisteria vine blooming for the second time that summer on a wooden trellis before one window, into which sparrows came now and then in random gusts, making a dry, vivid, dusty sound before going away. And opposite Quentin, Miss Coldfield in the eternal black, which she had worn for 43 years now, whether for sister, father, or not husband, none knew, sitting so bolt upright in that straight, hard chair that was so tall for her that her legs hung straight and rigid, as if she had iron shin bones and ankles, clear of the floor with that air of impotent and static rage like children's feet, and talking in that grim, haggard, amazed voice until at last listening would renege and hearing sense self-confound, and the long-dead object of her impotent yet indomitable frustration would appear, as though by outraged recapitulation evoked, quiet, inattentive, and harmless, out of the biting and dreamy and victorious dust.
Great reading, Josh. It's when you said this is one of your favorite opening sentences, I had to kind of laugh because it is more of a favorite opening paragraph, because this is an enormous sentence. And to start this book, I mean, Faulkner's letting you know what's about to happen to you. Like, he's not going to ease you into it. He's not going to make you think this is just going to be another book that you can breeze through. Like, he throws it all at you right up front. But it is beautiful. So it hopefully will, you know, bring readers in. But yeah, it's tough.
Right. My favorite part is when he says, "The long, still, hot, weary, dead September afternoon." Because there's a kind of a joke here. I was talking about earlier, Balzac, I believe it was, had a famous line saying, only a genius allows themselves 2 adjectives per sentence. And Faulkner says, you know, screw that. This is the game I'm going to play. As beautiful as these lines are in isolation, they are like molasses going through this book. Mm-hmm. And it sets the tone, because the story is being related in this dark space between an elderly woman and a young man who feels like he has to stand at attention out of his sense of duty and chivalry, even though he has no idea why he's being called here to do so. And it has that feeling of stillness and of heat, yeah, and of closure and stuffiness and inescapability that is going to go throughout the entire story.
It's very evocative, and it's very appropriate because Miss Rosa speaks about particular smells and sounds that bring back memories for her, And Sutpen does at some point later in the book as well. And to have that, to have the actual language of the book be able to do that for yourself, and you know, bring you to kind of your own personal memory, as it talks about, you know, characters who are experiencing this and experiencing that very personal, very intimate connection to the history of this story, I think is really important. And it really emphasizes how what is trying to be laid out as history is, in fact, a deeply personal series of stories that come together to create a history.
I wanted to bring up something that I think I may have brought up earlier when I was talking about The Old Man and the Sea on that episode. Faulkner and Hemingway both are considered part of the high modernist tradition in America, but they are sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to style. Mm-hmm. Here's a word you can try out at the next cocktail party you're at. There's a difference between what's called hypotaxis and parataxis. Parataxic sentences are ones that are joined together and. The effect is nothing causes anything else. They are just happening continuously. And that's the way that Hemingway would write. He would say something like, there was an old man and he lived alone and he lived in a house and the house was very old and he lived in it by the sea. And it has this evening effect that is very much like the work of Gertrude Stein.
Mm-hmm.
But Faulkner is hypotactic, which means all the clauses are subordinate to each other. It's all about the logical relationships between things. And there are parentheticals, there are dashed asides. There's a construction he uses all the time, which I find super amusing because I recognize it immediately when he's about to start winding up on one of these long sentences where he says, it was not
right.
blank, nor yet was it blank. But it was, in fact, blank.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of extremely deliberate, I'm going to make fine, fine distinctions here. It's not the way anyone actually talks.
No.
But it makes perfect sense in the way he writes.
Thank you for that. Now I'm going to blow away some English majors at the next cocktail party I go to.
Okay.
So, you know, the confusion that Sharif has when he's asking Quentin about his relationship to the South and, you know, all these events that took place before Quentin's birth, and yet Quentin goes back to these stories in search of himself. You know, there's so much to say there about how this exact practice occurs within, you know, national histories and cultural histories. And the South is obviously a very good example of this. But you can see it in other places as well. The Quebecois in Canada, they have, again, this very personal relationship with incidents that occurred long ago, but that directly shape their relationship with English Canada today. And you can see it in the way that minor conflicts in faraway countries are often explained in our media as ancient hatreds. And so the kind of bringing of the personal into ancient history, which is rather reductive and not entirely fair. The story of someone who is caught up in this very big and this very powerful culture and to naturally want to seek out their understanding of their own relationship to it. I think I quite appreciated that in this book.
I'd like to end with a little anecdote because I do live in Boston. If you go today to the Anderson Memorial Bridge, which is the bridge that connects Boston to Cambridge right near Harvard, and go halfway across, in one of the bricks there, you will find a plaque marking the place where Quentin Compson committed suicide.
Oh my gosh.
This was put there sometime in the 1960s. It's still mysterious who put it there originally. The plaque has been replaced after there was a renovation, and it reads currently, Quentin Compson, drowned in the odor of honeysuckle, 1891 to 1910.
Wow. Boston's such a cool city.
Thanks to co-host Ashley Challenor. The reading this time was done by Josh Hollis. Josh has a new podcast you should check out called Predictocast, available in all the usual places. As always, you can mail the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com or join us on the Facebook page. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. And remember, everything will be on the final.